With 20 arrows, I got 20 Taurens. They closed ranks every time one dropped. You didn't even have to aim. After running out of arrows, I tried throwing their darts back at them, but their light shields were quite adequate against the small missiles. We'd killed more than half of them with arrows and spears long before they got into range of the hand-to-hand weapons. I drew my sword and waited. They still outnumbered us by better than 3-1. When they got within 10 meters, the people with Grom throwing knives had their own field day. Although the spinning disc was easy enough to see and took more than a half second to get from thrower to target, most of the Taurens reacted in the same ineffective way, raising up the shield to ward it off. The razor-sharp, tempered, heavy blade cut through the light shield like a buzzsaw through cardboard. The first hand contact was with the quarterstaffs, which were metal rods 2 meters long that tapered at the ends to a double-edged, serrated knife blade. The Taurens had a cold-blooded, or valiant, if your mind works that way, method for dealing with them. They would simply grab the blade and die. While the human was trying to extricate his weapon from the frozen death grip, a Tauren swordsman, with a scimitar over a meter long, would step in and kill him. Besides the swords, they had a bolo-like thing that was a length of elastic cord that ended with about 10 centimeters of something like barbed wire and a small weight to propel it. It was a weapon for all concerned. If they missed their target, it would come snapping back unpredictably. But they hit their target pretty often, going under the shields and wrapping the thorny wire around ankles. I stood back to back with Private Erickson, and with our swords, we managed to stay alive for the next few minutes. When the Taurens were down to a couple of dozen survivors, they just turned around and started marching out. We threw some darts after them, getting 3, but we didn't want to chase after them. They might turn around and start hacking again. There were only 28 of us left standing. Nearly 10 times that number of dead Taurens littered the ground, but there was no satisfaction in it. They could do the whole thing over with a fresh 300, and this time it would work. We moved from body to body, pulling out arrows and spears, then took up places around the fighter again. Nobody bothered to retrieve the quarterstaffs. I counted noses. Charlie and Diana were still alive. Hillebo had been one of the quarterstaff victims, as well as 2 supporting officers, Wilbur and Sislautska. Rutkowski was still alive, but Orban had taken a dart. After a day of waiting, it looked as though the enemy had decided on a war of attrition rather than repeating the ground attack. Darts came in constantly, not in swarms anymore, but in 2s and 3s and 10s, and from all different angles. We couldn't stay alert forever. They'd get somebody every 3 or 4 hours. We took turns sleeping 2 at a time, on top of the stasis field generator. Sitting directly under the bulk of the fighter, it was the safest place in the dome. Every now and then, a Tauren would appear at the edge of the field, evidently to see whether any of us were left. Sometimes we'd shoot an arrow at him, for practice. The darts stopped falling after a couple of days. I supposed it was possible that they'd simply run out of them, or maybe they decided to stop when we were down to 20 survivors. There was a more likely possibility. I took one of the quarterstaffs down to the edge of the field and poked it through, 1 centimeter or so. When I drew it back, the point was melted off. When I showed it to Charlie, he rocked back and forth, the only way you can nod in a suit. This sort of thing had happened before. One of the first times the stasis field hadn't worked. They simply saturated it with laser fire and waited for us to go stir-crazy and turn off the generator. They were probably sitting in their ships playing the Tauren equivalent of pinochle. I tried to think. It was hard to keep your mind on something for any length of time in that hostile environment, sense-deprived, looking over your shoulder every few seconds. Something Charlie had said only yesterday. I couldn't track it down. It wouldn't have worked then, that was all I could remember. Then, finally, it came to me. I called everyone over and wrote in the snow, "Get Nova bombs from ship. Carry to edge of field. Move field." Szlaska knew where the proper tools would be aboard ship. Luckily, we had left all of the entrances open before turning on the stasis field. They were electronic and would have been frozen shut. We got an assortment of wrenches from the engine room and climbed up to the cockpit. He knew how to remove the access plate that exposed a crawl space into the bomb bay. I followed him in through the meter-wide tube. Normally, I supposed, it would have been pitch black, but the stasis field illuminated the bomb bay with the same dim, shadowless light that prevailed outside. The bomb bay was too small for both of us, so I stayed at the end of the crawl space and watched. The bomb bay doors had a manual override, so they were easy. Szlaska just turned a hand crank, and we were in business. Freeing the two Nova bombs from their cradles was another thing. Finally, he went back down to the engine room and brought back a crowbar. He pried one loose, and I got the other, and we rolled them out the bomb bay. Sergeant Angeloff was already working on them by the time we climbed back down. All you had to do to arm the bomb was to unscrew the fuse on the nose of it and poke something around in the fuse socket to wreck the delay mechanism and safety restraints. We carried them quickly to the edge, 6 people per bomb, and set them down next to each other. Then we waved to the 4 people who were standing by at the field generator's handles. They picked it up and walked 10 paces in the opposite direction. The bombs disappeared as the edge of the field slid over them. There was no doubt that the bombs went off. For a couple of seconds, it was as hot as the interior of a star outside, and even the stasis field took notice of the fact. About a third of the dome glowed a dull pink for a moment, then was gray again. There was a slight acceleration, like you would feel in a slow elevator. That meant we were drifting down to the bottom of the crater. Would there be a solid bottom, or would we sink down through molten rock to be trapped like a fly in amber? Didn't pay to even think about that. Perhaps if it happened, we could blast our way out with the fighter's gigawatt laser. 12 of us, anyhow. "How long?" Charlie scraped in the snow at my feet. That was a damn good question. About all I knew was the amount of energy 2 Nova bombs released. I didn't know how big a fireball they would make, which would determine the temperature at detonation and the size of the crater. I didn't know the heat capacity of the surrounding rock or its boiling point. I wrote, "1 week, shrug, have to think." The ship's computer could have told me in a 1/1000th of a second, but it wasn't talking. I started writing equations in the snow, trying to get a maximum and minimum figure for the length of time it would take for the outside to cool down to 500 degrees. Angeloff, whose physics was much more up to date, did his own calculations on the other side of the ship. My answer said anywhere from 6 hours to 6 days, although for 6 hours the surrounding rock would have to conduct heat like pure copper, and Angeloff got 5 hours to 4.5 days. I voted for 6, and nobody else got a vote. We slept a lot. Charlie and Diana played chess by scraping cymbals in the snow. I was never able to hold the shifting positions of the pieces in my mind. I checked my figures several times and kept coming up with 6 days. I checked Angeloff's computations, too, and they seemed all right, but I stuck to my guns. It wouldn't hurt us to stay in the suits an extra day and a half. We argued good-naturedly, in terse shorthand. There had been 19 of us left the day we tossed the bombs outside. There were still 19, 6 days later, when I paused with my hand over the generator's cutoff switch. What was waiting for us out there? Surely we had killed all the Torrens within several clicks of the explosion. But there might have been a reserve force farther away, now waiting patiently on the crater's lip. At least you could push a quarterstaff through the field and have it come back whole. I dispersed the people evenly around the area so they might not get us with a single shot. Then, ready to turn it back on immediately if anything went wrong, I pushed. Chapter 8. My radio was still tuned to the general frequency. After more than a week of silence, my ears were suddenly assaulted with loud, happy babbling. We stood in the center of a crater almost a kilometer wide and deep. Its sides were a shiny black crust, shot through with red cracks, hot but no longer dangerous. The hemisphere of Earth that we rested on had sunk a good 40 meters into the floor of the crater, while it had still been molten, so now we stood on a kind of pedestal. Not a Torren in sight. We rushed to the ship, sealed it, and filled it with cool air, and popped our suits. I didn't press seniority for the one shower, just sat back in an acceleration couch and took deep breaths of air that didn't smell like recycled Mandela. The ship was designed for a maximum crew of 12, so we stayed outside in shifts of 7 to keep from straining the life support systems. I sent a repeating message to the other fighter, which was still over 6 weeks away, that we were in good shape and waiting to be picked up. I was reasonably certain he would have 7 free berths, since the normal crew for a combat mission was only 3. It was good to walk around and talk again. I officially suspended all things military for the duration of our stay on the planet. Some of the people were survivors of Brill's mutinous bunch, but they didn't show any hostility toward me. We played a kind of nostalgia game, comparing the various eras we'd experienced on Earth, wondering what it would be like in the 700 years future we were going back to. Nobody mentioned the fact that we would, at best, go back to a few months' furlough and then be assigned to another strike force, another turn of the wheel. Wheels. One day Charlie asked me from what country my name originated. It sounded weird to him. I told him it originated from the lack of a dictionary, and that if it were spelled right, it would look even weirder. I got to kill a good half hour explaining all the peripheral details to that. Basically, though, my parents were hippies, a kind of subculture in the late 20th century America that rejected materialism and embraced a broad spectrum of odd ideas, who lived with a group of other hippies in a small agricultural community. When my mother got pregnant, they wouldn't be so conventional as to get married. This entailed the woman taking the man's name and implied that she was his property. But they got all intoxicated and sentimental and decided they would both change their names to be the same. They rode into the nearest town, arguing all the way as to what name would be the best symbol for the love bond between them. I narrowly missed having a much shorter name, and they settled on Mandala. A mandala is a wheel-like design the hippies had borrowed from a foreign religion that symbolized the cosmos, the cosmic mind, God, or whatever needed a symbol. Neither my mother nor my father knew how to spell the word, and the magistrate in town wrote it down the way it sounded to him. They named me William in honor of a wealthy uncle, who unfortunately died penniless. The 6 weeks passed rather pleasantly. talking, reading, resting. The other ship landed next to ours and did have 9 free berths. We shuffled crew so that each ship had someone who could get it out of trouble if the pre-programmed jump sequence malfunctioned. I assigned myself to the other ship in hopes it would have some new books. It didn't. We zipped up in the tanks and took off simultaneously. We wound up spending a lot of time in the tanks just to keep from looking at the same faces all day long in the crowded ship. The added periods of acceleration got us back to Stargate in 10 months, subjective. Of course, it was 340 years, minus 7 months, to the hypothetical objective observer. There were hundreds of cruisers in orbit around Stargate. Bad news. With that kind of backlog, we probably wouldn't get any furlough at all. I supposed I was more likely to get a court-martial than a furlough, anyhow. Losing 88% of my company, many of them because they didn't have enough confidence in me to obey the direct earthquake order. And we were back where we'd started, on Sada 138. No Torrens there, but no base either. We got landing instructions and went straight down. No shuttle. There was another surprise waiting at the spaceport. Dozens of cruisers were standing around on the ground. They'd never done that before for fear that Stargate would be hit. And 2 captured Torren cruisers as well. We'd never managed to get one intact. 7 centuries could have brought us a decisive advantage, of course. Maybe we were winning. We went through an airlock under a returnees sign. After the air cycled and we'd popped our suits, a beautiful young woman came in with a cartload of tunics and told us in perfectly accented English to get dressed and go to the lecture hall at the end of the corridor to our left. The tunic felt odd, light yet warm. It was the first thing I'd worn besides a fighting suit or bare skin in almost a year. The lecture hall was about 100 times too big for the 22 of us. The same woman was there and asked us to move down to the front. That was unsettling. I could have sworn she had gone down the corridor the other way. I knew she had. I'd been captivated by the sight of her clothed behind. Hell, maybe they had matter transmitters, or teleportation. Wanted to save herself a few steps. We sat for a minute, and a man, clothed in the same kind of unadorned tunic the woman and we were wearing, walked across the stage with a stack of thick notebooks under each arm. The woman followed him on, also carrying notebooks. I looked behind me, and she was still standing in the aisle. To make things even more odd, the man was virtually a twin to both of them. The man riffled through one of the notebooks and cleared his throat. "These books are for your convenience," he said, also with perfect accent. "And you don't have to read them if you don't want to. You don't have to do anything you don't want to do, because you're free men and women. The war is over." Disbelieving silence. "As you will read in this book, the war ended 221 years ago. Accordingly, this is the year 220. Old style, of course. It is 3138 A.D. You are the last group of soldiers to return. When you leave here, I will leave as well, and destroy Stargate. It exists only as a rendezvous point for returnees, and as a monument to human stupidity and shame. As you will read, destroying it will be a cleansing." He stopped speaking, and the woman started without a pause. "I am sorry for what you've been through, and wish I could say that it was for good cause, but as you will read, it was not. Even the wealth you have accumulated back salary and compound interest, is worthless, as I no longer use money or credit, nor is there such a thing as an economy in which to use these things. As you must have guessed by now, the man took over, we are clones of a single individual, some 250 years ago. My name was Khan. Now it is Man. I had a direct ancestor in your company, a Corporal Larry Khan. It saddens me that he didn't come back. I am over 10 billion individuals, but only one consciousness, she said. After you read, I will try to clarify this. I know that it will be difficult to understand. No other humans are quickened, since I am the perfect pattern. Individuals who die are replaced. There are some planets, however, on which humans are born in the normal mammalian way. If my society is too alien for you, you may go to one of these planets. If you wish to take part in procreation, I will not discourage it. Many veterans ask me to change their polarity to heterosexual so that they can more easily fit into these other societies. This I can do very easily. Don't worry about that, man. Just make out my ticket. You will be my guest here at Stargate for 10 days, after which you will be taken wherever you want to go, he said. Please read this book in the meantime. Feel free to ask any questions or request any service. They both stood and walked off the stage. Charlie was sitting next to me. Incredible, he said. They encourage men and women to do that again? Together? The female aisle man was sitting behind us, and she answered before I could frame a reasonably sympathetic, hypocritical reply. It isn't a judgment on your society, she said, probably not seeing that he took it a little more personally than that. I only feel that it's necessary as a eugenic safety device. I have no evidence that there is anything wrong with cloning only one ideal individual, but if it turns out to have been a mistake, there will be a large genetic pool with which to start again. She patted him on the shoulder. Of course, you don't have to go to these breeder planets. You can stay on one of my planets. I make no distinction between heterosexual play and homosexual. She went up on the stage to give a long spiel about where we were going to stay and eat and so forth while we were on Stargate. Never been seduced by a computer before, Charlie muttered. The 1,143-year-long war had been begun on false pretenses and only continued because the two races were unable to communicate. Once they could talk, the first question was, why did you start this thing? And the answer was, me? The Torrens hadn't known war for millennia, and toward the beginning of the 21st century, it looked as though mankind was ready to outgrow the institution as well. But the old soldiers were still around, and many of them were in positions of power. They virtually ran the United Nations Exploratory and Colonization Group. That was taking advantage of the newly discovered collapsar jump to explore interstellar space. Many of the early ships met with accidents and disappeared. The ex-military men were suspicious. They armed the colonizing vessels, and the first time they met a Torren ship, they blasted it. They dusted off their medals, and the rest was going to be history. You couldn't blame it all on the military, though. The evidence they presented for the Torrens having been responsible for the earlier casualties was laughably thin. The few people who pointed this out were ignored. The fact was, Earth's economy needed a war, and this one was ideal. It gave a nice hole to throw buckets of money into, but would unify humanity rather than dividing it. The Torrens relearned war, after a fashion. They never got really good at it, and would eventually have lost. The Torrens, the book explained, couldn't communicate with humans because they had no concept of the individual. They had been natural clones for millions of years. Eventually, Earth's cruisers were manned by man, con-clones, and they were, for the first time, able to get through to each other. The book stated this as a bald fact. I asked a man to explain what it meant, what was special about clone-to-clone communication, and he said that I, a priori, couldn't understand it. There were no words for it, and my brain wouldn't be able to accommodate the concepts even if there were words. All right, it sounded a little fishy, but I was willing to accept it. I'd accept that up was down if it meant the war was over. Man was a pretty considerate entity. Just for us 22, he went to the trouble of rejuvenating a little restaurant tavern and staffing it at all hours. I never saw a man eat or drink. Guess they'd discovered a way around it. I was sitting in there one evening, drinking beer and reading their book, when Charlie came in and sat down next to me. Without preamble, he said, I'm going to give it a try. Give what a try? Women? Hetero? He shuddered. No offense, it's not really very appealing. He patted my hand, looking distracted. But the alternative. Have you tried it? Well, no, I haven't. Female man was a visual treat, but only in the same sense as a painting or a piece of sculpture. I just couldn't see them as human beings. Don't. He didn't elaborate. Besides, they say, he says, she says, it says, that they can change me back just as easily, if I don't like it. You'll like it, Charlie. Sure, that's what they say. He ordered a stiff drink. Just seems unnatural. Anyway, since I'm going to make the switch, do you mind if... Why don't we plan on going to the same planet? Sure, Charlie, that'd be great. I meant it. You know where you're going? Hell, I don't care. Just away from here. I wonder if heaven still is nice. No. Charlie jerked a thumb at the bartender. He lives there. I don't know. I guess there's a list. A man came into the tavern pushing a cart piled high with folders. Major Mandela? Captain Moore? That's us, Charlie said. These are your military records. I hope you find them of interest. They were transferred to paper when your strike force was the only one outstanding, because it would have been impractical to keep the normal data retrieval networks running to preserve so few data. They always anticipated your questions, even when you didn't have any. My folder was easily 5 times as thick as Charlie's, probably thicker than any other, since I seemed to be the only trooper who'd made it through the whole duration. Poor Mary Gay. Wonder what kind of report old Stott filed about me. I flipped to the front of the folder. Stapled to the front page was a small square of paper. All the other pages were pristine white, but this one was tan with age and crumbling around the edges. The handwriting was familiar, too familiar, even after so long. The date was over 250 years old. I winced and was blinded by sudden tears. I'd had no reason to suspect that she might be alive, but I hadn't really known she was dead, not until I saw that date. William, what's... Leave me be, Charlie, just for a minute. I wiped my eyes and closed the folder. I shouldn't even read the damn note. Going to a new life, I should leave the old ghosts behind. But even a message from the grave was contact of a sort. I opened the folder again. 11 October, 2878. William. All this is in your personnel file, but knowing you, you might just chuck it, so I made sure you'd get this note. Obviously, I lived. Maybe you will, too. Join me. I know from the records that you're out at Sada 138 and won't be back for a couple of centuries. No problem. I'm going to a planet they call Middle Finger, the fifth planet out from Mizar. It's 2 collapsar jumps, 10 months objective. Middle Finger is a kind of Coventry for heterosexuals. They call it a eugenic control baseline. No matter, it took all of my money and all the money of 5 other old-timers, but we bought a cruiser from UNIF, and we're using it as a time machine. So I'm on a relativistic shuttle, waiting for you. All it does is go out 5 light years and come back to Middle Finger very fast. Every 10 years I age about a month. So if you're on schedule and still alive, I'll only be 28 when you get here. Hurry. I never found anybody else, and I don't want anybody else. I don't care whether you're 90 years old or 30. If I can't be your lover, I'll be your nurse. Mary Gay. Say, bartender? Yes, Major. Do you know of a place called Middle Finger? Is it still there? Of course it is. Where else would it be?
Reasonable question.
A very nice place. Garden planet. Some people don't think it's exciting enough.
What's this all about? Charlie said. I handed the bartender my empty glass. I just found out where we're going.
Chapter 9. Epilogue. From The New Voice, Paxton, Middle Finger, 24-6. 14-2-3143. Old-timer has first boy. Mary Gay Potter Mandela, 24 Post Road, Paxton, gave birth Friday last to a fine baby boy, 3.1 kilos. Mary Gay lays claim to being the second oldest resident of Middle Finger, having been born in 1977. She fought through most of the Forever War and then waited for her mate on the time shuttle, 261 years. The baby, not yet named, was delivered at home with the help of a friend of the family, Dr. Diana Alsever Moore.
The End. You've been listening to The Forever War by Joe Haldeman, narrated by George Wilson. If you've enjoyed this book and this performance, Recorded Books recommends these other books narrated by George Wilson, Invasion of the Body Snatchers by Jack Finney, and The Cat Who Walks Through Walls by Robert A. Heinlein. You'll find a wide selection of titles in the Recorded Books catalog, including bestsellers, mysteries, classics, histories, and more. So to order another Recorded Book or for a copy of our latest listing, please call us using the telephone number on the back of the book. You can order by phone with any major credit card, or by writing to us, or by faxing us. Don't forget to ask about easy 30-day rentals by mail. On our website, you can browse the catalog, hear about the latest releases, place orders, or tune into narrator profiles and author interviews. So visit us there at www.recordedbooks.com. And thank you for being a Recorded Books reader.